Good evening, you guys. I'm K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin TechNet number 1648. Number 1648 is rescheduled this week. Got canceled last week, so to speak. As you guys know, the main purpose of the TechNet is to gather the clan of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about their equipment. And one of the things that we hear discussed quite frequently is that the TechNet does do an awful lot of discussion of antennas. And there's a number of reasons for that. One, it's my favorite subject, but I suddenly realized that when I got my ham license way back in the 50s, 1956 to be exact, roughly half of the equipment that amateurs used, they built. They built their own transmitters, they built their own receivers. I realized that I have built, over the years, 8 transmitters. The power kilowatt, the amplifier, tripler, an 807, a pair of 807, there's the drive for it, let me think, a 6L6 novice rig that was on 3.75 megacycles, the novice CW frequencies and so on. So I built 8 transmitters altogether. One of them was a 6-meter fully indirect frequency synthesized, direct frequency synthesized rig that went from 50 to 54 megacycles with 1 kilohertz of resolution throughout that whole frequency region. That was way back in, I think now, 1965, I think I built it, 1963, in that order. So, we used to build our own equipment. My first receiver I built, it happened to be a Heathkit, but the transmitters were built from scratch. Nowadays, the rigs you...
Repeater, timeout.
Nowadays, the rigs that you can buy from Southeast Asia, made by the big three, Kenwood, Icom, too, and quite a few other brands, you get a lot more bang for the money to buy the rig as opposed to building it. And when it comes to the really inexpensive rigs these days, Wuxon and Baofeng, you never want to build a thing like that. So we no longer build our transmitters, we no longer build our receivers, but we do build our antennas in many cases. And so arguably the antenna is one of the most important portions of the rig. Okay, a person signs into the TechNet by giving us your call letters, your name, the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Let me drop. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After, let's see, 1982 to now is 34 and a half years of TechNet. By now we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So give me your call letters, your name and call letters, and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment at this time. K2RIW listening.
WA2RYY, Joe, yes.
Okay, we've got Joe. Anyone else?
ED2HUC, yes.
Okay, KD2HUC. Anyone else?
WS2N with the space report. Good evening. Dick.
Very fine, Paul. And I think you're going to be giving us space report number 248 of the series tonight. And I believe there was a launch that was supposed to take place of SpaceX that got canceled. And so I'm quite sure you'll be giving us some further information on that. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. I have a question from the mailbag, and don't worry about time. Everything's fine here. So whenever you're finished with the regular check-ins, we'll go on to that.
Very fine, John. All glad to hear from you. KC2WGB. Okay, looks like we've only got 2 check-ins so far tonight, Joe and Steve. And so let's go over to Joe. K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, well, you have the my question from Flavius. That's what I'm going to ask is looking at radar, Doppler, shift frequency, and so forth, How is that calculated, or how does that actually work out? Maybe if you just go through a simple explanation, maybe that might help further answer my question, which is, I tried calculating one using a radar gun, and I come up with something a little different in calculation than what you actually get from the pitch that equal makes the radar gun operate correctly. Back to you.
I had a quick conversation with Joe earlier tonight, an hour or two ago, in which I got some of the details of what he's talking about. Joe has in his possession a radar speed trap, a law enforcement type, a radar indicator, Doppler radar indicator. In other words, it tells you the speed of a vehicle approaching the equipment that you park at the side of the road. The particular one he has radiates a signal at 24.15 gigahertz. 24,150 megahertz is the frequency it transmits. Most of them in the old days used to be a so-called gunplexer. In other words, it was a chunk of equipment about the size of your fist. The main RF front end was about the size of your fist. Inside was a gun diode. In this case, the gun diode would be oscillating directly at 24.15 gigahertz. The gun diode transmits a signal of approximately 100 milliwatts out a feed horn, a waveguide, a piece of probably WR45 or so waveguide, KU band or KA band waveguide, into a horn. The horn itself is probably, I'm going to make a guess, in the vicinity of 2 inches square, the mouth of the horn. And that transmits a signal that goes out and hits the automobile. Let me drop it. After the signal bounces off the automobile, a certain percentage of it, a small amount of it, comes back to that horn, the exact same horn that did the transmitting. It re-enters that piece of waveguide. Buried in that piece of waveguide is a ferrite rod. It looks like a ferrite rod. It's actually an exotic material. I think it's barium tetratitanate. I'm not quite sure of the actual material. It's a circulator. It's got a magnetic, steady-state magnet on the ends of the rod, and the rod goes through the waveguide. And that circulator means that the majority of the signal that would ordinarily be bouncing off the horn, because the horn has a small amount of standing wave ratio, particularly if somebody's holding their hand near the front of the horn, quite a bit of signal is coming back. And that circulator makes sure that not very much of the transmitted signal directly hits the detecting diode that's in the back of the horn. So the circulator tries to separate the outgoing and the incoming signal, because this literally is a CW radar. Because the signal bouncing off the automobile is experiencing Doppler shift, let's say the automobile is approaching this Doppler scanner, and therefore the signal coming back will be higher in frequency. It'll be blue shifted, as they say. And how much higher in frequency is a relatively easy calculation, the Doppler shift frequency. Let me drop. You could, if you want to, look up the equation that tells you how much Doppler shift you're going to get, knowing the velocity of the automobile and knowing the frequency you're operating at. And so you can just plug in the numbers. But if you really want to know what's going on, you calculate, knowing the frequency, you calculate what is the wavelength. And you know that the signal is going to make the path twice, out to the vehicle, bouncing off the vehicle, and coming back. So for every foot the vehicle moves toward you, the total path length gets shorter by 2 feet. So if the vehicle was moving let's see, 60 miles an hour is 88 feet per second. If the vehicle was moving 60 miles an hour, 88 feet per second times 2 would be, what, 176. In other words, the path length would be shortening 176 feet every second of the signal going out and coming back to you. And once you know the wavelength, you can calculate how many wavelengths are in that 176 feet. And if that happened to be, I'm going to pick a number out of here, 3,000 wavelengths. In other words, your path length is getting shorter by 3,000 wavelengths every second in my rep of example. And therefore, a signal coming back versus a signal that went out will be 3 kilohertz, 3,000 wavelengths, 3 kilohertz higher in frequency. and you know what happens when you're zero beating a transmitter. Let me drop. Before we had synthesized rigs, in the old days, you had a variable frequency oscillator on your transmitter, and you would have a tune mode on your transmitter where a weak amount of signal out of your VFO would go into the receiver at the exact same time you're listening to the guy you're about to talk to. And you would adjust the VFO until you hear a zero beat. You hear the tone between the two signals beating against each other, and when the tone goes to a zero hertz, you know that your VFO is on the exact same frequency of the signal you're listening to. The CW mode in this particular case, to keep it simple. So, zero beating, when you're off zero beat, if your VFO was set 3 kilohertz high, you literally would hear a heterodyne of 3 kilohertz in your receiver. So there was a detecting diode in the back end of that gun plexer assembly of this radar detector, and then there is a low-pass filter. I'm not sure exactly what the frequency is. Maybe it's a 10 or 15 kilohertz low-pass filter. It's looking for the audio tone coming out of that detecting diode. And after that is a circuitry that interprets that tone into miles per hour. Let me drop. Now, in order to test the accuracy of the whole system, the way a law enforcement officer often does it, is he has a well-calibrated tuning fork. He strikes the tuning fork, holds it in front of the radar detector, and he should get a predictable amount of miles per hour indication. In the case of one that Joe has, his tuning fork is at 3633 hertz is the tuning fork. He strikes the tuning fork, holds it in front of the gun plexer, and he expected to see an indication of 50 miles an hour. Well, I did a quick calculation, and I found out that 24.15 gigahertz and exactly 50 miles an hour has, by my standards, a calculated Doppler shift of 3.601 kilohertz is what I calculate. He should be measuring for 50 miles an hour. Because he's got a tuning fork that's slightly higher, in theory, he must be indicating slightly above 50 miles an hour, I am guessing. Your next question is going to be, how in the world does the tuning fork sitting in front of this equipment indicate 50 miles an hour? Let me drop. There is nothing in that tuning fork moving at 50 miles an hour. At first you would think, hey, the tangs of the tuning fork are moving in and out, and maybe they're moving one thousandth of an inch, depending on how hard you strike the tuning fork, and it's making that tone. And you could calculate a thousandth of an inch on each cycle, and 3,000, so to speak, cycles per second. How fast is the tuning fork moving? It's an extremely small fraction of 50 miles an hour. So how in the world can this indicate 50 miles an hour? And by the way, if it's dependent on the speed of the tangs of the tuning fork, it wouldn't be a very good speed calibrator, because when you first strike the tuning fork, the tangs are moving very far. As the tuning fork starts settling down, the tangs are not moving as far, and therefore the total velocity of the tangs is getting smaller and smaller. It would be a pretty terrible calibrator that wouldn't give you a steady apparent miles per hour if it depended on the speed of the tank. It does not. Can we drop? What the tangs do, if the tangs are moving, in my guess, a thousandth of an inch, which is around 2 millimeters, or is it 0.2 millimeters is the actual distance in meters, the wavelength that John is using, I mean, Joe is using, let me drop. Finding the right page on my calculator, where the wavelength at 24,150 hertz is 1.24 centimeters. So 1.241 centimeters is the wavelength of 24.15 gigahertz. And so the thousandth of an inch, when you go through that calculation of movement, represents a displacement of a very small fraction of a wavelength. That very small fraction of a wavelength turns out to be, when you multiply it by 360 degrees, is 1.4 degrees. So the movement of the tangs of the tuning fork are creating a phase shift of the oscillator, a cyclic phase shift. 3 kilohertz is the tuning fork frequency rate, and it's moving approximately 1.5 degrees in RF phase because of the movement of the tuning fork tank when you calculate the round trip path. So you're getting a signal reflected from the tuning fork, which is angular modulated. Not much amplitude modulation there, angular modulation. Well, whether the signal coming back to the gunplexer is angular modulated or amplitude modulated almost doesn't matter, because in either case, the diode detector is going to hear some kind of an audio tone, and the circuitry is now going to be creating a an apparent miles per hour out of that tone. Let me drop. Whenever you have modulation of either angular, phase shift modulation, or amplitude, in either case, you're creating side lobes. And I made a rough guess that 1 degree of modulation of the 1 degree of phase shift, that modulation is giving you a signal something like 30 or 36 kilohertz, 30 or 36 decibels weaker than the carrier. And that's exactly what the signal is looking, what the gun flexor is looking for. The signal coming back that's reflected off the automobile is in that same signal strength. So the toning fork gives you a phony signal, creating the right apparent Doppler shift. In this case, it's not Doppler shift, it's angular modulation. But the circuitry doesn't give a darn whether it's amplitude modulated, phase modulated, frequency modulated. As long as that it's creating a side lobe that can be detected by the crystal detector, and the audio circuitry after that will interpret it into apparent miles per hour. So, as I said, at exactly 50 miles an hour, I think you should have seen 3.601 kilohertz. Your tuning fork is 36, 33. Therefore, in theory, it should read slightly higher than 50 miles an hour. I didn't calculate how much higher, maybe 1 mile an hour higher. However, that's based on the assumption that somebody hasn't turned one of the tuning screws in there, which is very easy to do. These gunplexer assemblies, let me drop them. They often have a tuning screw in there, and the particular 10 gigahertz gunplexer that I own, I think I could move it a couple of 100 megahertz just by adjusting the tuning screw. So if you got an apparent error in miles per hour, the easiest place where that could have happened is what you think is 24.150, because that's what 24.15 gigahertz, according to the label on this instrument. It's probably banged around, sold on the flea market, ended up in your hands, and maybe somebody turned one of the screws one day. So if you had a way of measuring the frequency, I'll bet you'll find out that a slight error in the frequency, 24.15, would explain the apparent miles per hour error. So how many miles per hour did it indicate on that tuning fork, Joe? W-H-L-Y-Y, K-2-I-W in the TechNet.
The unit indicated 50 miles per hour on the display. Now, I've also checked the accuracy of this unit by using a GPS in the car. Most GPSs will give you speed readout to at least a tenth of a mile per hour or better in accuracy, and it matches the GPS right on. It's funny, though, the tuning fork says 50 mph on it, stamped, but it says 3394. And I thought that's what the frequency was, but it took me a little while with my service monitor to actually zero beat and find the actual frequency of being 3633. Now, here's something else I did. I replaced the tuning fork with a speaker. Hooked the speaker to my signal generator, audio output, audio generator, which is very accurate, better than a tenth of a hertz. And at 7266, it indicated 100 miles per hour. At 108.99 hertz, it indicated 150, 151 miles per hour. So at least that showed me it was sort of linear in its function.
By the way, I just did the calculation right now. As I said, 50 miles an hour should have been 3.601 kilohertz of Doppler shift. Because your tuning fork is not 3601, but 3633, that calculates to be an indicated miles per hour of 50.44. So, depending on the resolution of the miles per hour indicated, that very small amount of error maybe wouldn't even show up on the screen. So if you read 50 miles an hour instead of 50.44, close enough as I see it. Now, whether you move the tangs of a tuning fork, whether you move the speaker of a loudspeaker, no matter what you move, if you move something at roughly 3.6 kilohertz rate and hold it in front of that gun flexor, you're going to get 50 miles an hour. Or you go to twice that frequency, you're going to get 100 miles an hour. So it doesn't care what the object is, as long as there's some number of fractions of a wavelength movement which creates a phase shift of the signal coming back, and the signal coming back versus the signal going out beating against each other creates these side lobes, creates the signal that's detected by the crystal detector, and the circuitry says, aha, 50 miles an hour. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, I checked the accuracy of this against actually two different GPS units, and both GPS units indicated my speed correctly. You know, in fact, I tested at 50 miles an hour on an open road with nothing else near me, where it was cruise control on. And the car held very close to 50 miles per hour. The radar gun indicated 50 miles per hour, and it only has one digit, you know, plus or minus one digit. It's not like 50.1 or 50.2. You just get 50, 51, or 49. It's like, you know, there's only two digits display, three digits display, but under 100, you only get two digits. So the radar, you're telling me the tuning fork frequency should have been lower, but actually what I read in, as far as accuracy, it seemed to be correct. So this is where a little bit of a mystery comes in as far as what I measure and what it actually turns out to be in reality. But it's interesting now. It's an interesting subject to talk about.
What you got there, Joe, is a real fun piece of highly scientific hardware doing a very sophisticated measurement, and yet because of the great creation of bulk effect oscillators, a gun diode is called a bulk effect oscillator, detected, first invented by Mr. Gunn, that's why it's got his name on it. And so this very simple circuit doesn't require an oscillator, a multiplier assembly, a phase lock loop, doesn't require all of that jazz. It's a fairly simple circuit, and yet it makes a very sophisticated measurement. If I wanted to go out and buy a radar detector, a radar speed indicating gun like you got right now, and if I had enough contacts with people in the surplus market, where would I go and roughly how much would I have to pay? That's a real fun instrument. And the reason I'm saying this, Joe, is that if you tap into that circuitry at the right point where that 3.6 kilohertz signal is coming back, let me drop it. And if you now connected that to an audio amplifier in a loudspeaker, if you literally listened to the tone that the circuitry is interpreting into miles per hour, take the output of that crystal diode detector, maybe after one stage of audio amplification, and you send that into an audio amplifier and you play it into your earphones or a loudspeaker, you'll be amazed how much fun that thing is to listen to when you have it mounted in the windshield of your car when you're driving your automobile. All the stuff on the side of the road, each individual reflecting object, is going to give you a tone. The tones will not all be the same, because some of the objects are directly in front of you, some of the off to the side at a 45-degree angle, some of the objects are exactly at a 90-degree angle. At exactly a 90-degree angle to your travel, there is no Doppler shift. Directly in front of you, you get full Doppler shift. 45 degrees left to one side, you get 70% of the Doppler shift. So individual reflecting objects, trees, buildings, fire hydrants, and whatever, are all going to give you a tone of a slightly different tone frequency. The automobiles that are in front of you are moving almost your speed. They're going to give you a very low tone. The automobiles coming in the opposing lane, coming toward you, are going to give you a very high tone. There was a guy who once hooked up an audio amplifier. Let me drop it. For one of these things, and he played it over a loudspeaker while he drove his automobile. It is the wildest sounding swishing tone frequency you've ever heard, and there's a lot of intelligence in those tones. So when you get a chance, add an audio amplifier to that. You'll really be amazed at what you hear. But if I wanted to go out and buy one of those, what you've got right now, where would I go and roughly what would I have to pay? Who would I have to kill to get one of those, Joe? W-H-2-L-Y-Y, you're a lucky guy to have one. K-2-L-I-W in the TechNet.
Years ago, I had access, it wasn't mine, I had access to another one belonging to actually a police department, but I had access to it for a very short amount of time, and I did play with it in the car. And that one was a fixed roll. You put the thing in the side window, and that one did have an audio output. And it exactly did what you said. As you drove the car, it hit different objects, cars passing the other way, signs on the side of the road, trees and so forth. You'd get different pictures for different things. The device I had is called a Custom, K-U-S-T-O-M, Custom, KR-15. Look it up on eBay.
So these sometimes appear on eBay, on the flea market, so to speak. And roughly how many dollars are they selling for, Joe? Is there somebody who's got a warehouse full of those where you can get them at a fairly nice rate? Over to you, Joe.
I was trying to look at eBay a moment ago, and it wouldn't come up. I'm not sure what the... Oh, it's still not coming up. I'm searching for something, so eBay's got a problem with it. Later on, if I get eBay to come up on my computer, I'll put that in. I'm sure that you can see it. This item is like about 35 years old or more, because it almost has what you call, it doesn't have Nixie tubes, but the display almost looks like the old Nixie tubes you'd have in the old vacuum tube voltmeters. That's how old this thing is. It's definitely not new. So you could probably get one for a very cheap price, and not a lot of money at all. If I see one on eBay later, I'll come back on the I'll let you know what the price is, because you're curious about that. Okay.
WS1.
Okay, Paul recognized, and I'm also thinking about a buddy of mine who flies an airplane, and boy, would he like to have a device like that. That can indicate how fast his aircraft is coming up to the runway during a landing. And that might really make the life very, very easy for what he's trying to do. Paul, WS2N, K2IW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Walmart has it. I mean, you can't go into the store and buy it, but you can probably order it through them. They advertise it for $98, but not for cars. It's for... pitching. You can throw that 90 mile an hour fastball. One of those things. $98, that's not bad. back to you, Dick.
That's good to know, Paul. Thank you. $98 for essentially a brand new one, ready to measure the speed of a thrown baseball. And my guess is it would also work very nicely on a tennis ball, ping pong ball, and so on. But, with an audio amplifier and you aim that out the window while driving your automobile, you'd be amazed to hear those tones. And it's a very scientific signal. That's the real world of radar, if you know what I mean. And so, in theory, you could be listening to those tones as a blind man walking down the street. The amplitude of the tone will tell you the combination of how close and how big is the object in front of you. The pitch of the tone will tell you how fast you're approaching that object, or whether or not it's moving away from you, and so on. So, in theory, a person with a good set of hearing and the right kind of practice, as a blind person, could use that and have not exact sight, but at least an awful lot of the vital information as to what's in front of him, and is he approaching a wall, is he approaching a telephone pole, and so on, a fire hydrant. It sure would be nice to know that. Anything further you want to tell us about this beautiful thing? So you've had it for quite a few years, Joe, and I guess you dusted it off, brought it off the shelf, put it in operation, took the tuning fork out of the box that it was stored in, struck the tuning fork in front of it, got the right answer, and then went to twice the frequency into a loudspeaker and proved that it would read at least up to 100 miles an hour. I wonder what's the maximum speed you think it'll read, Joe?
W2LYY, K2IW in the TechNet. WB2HWW with a comment on your last comment, Dick.
1, 2, 3, 4. It reached 188 miles an hour.
Wow. So you could use that at a racetrack. How are we going to go ahead? Do you think some of them read even higher than 188? Over to you, Howie.
All right, sorry about taking so long to come back. Dick, your last comment, they make change. I have never used them, but they have, because I use a Sig iDog, but they have a cane that costs a few hundred dollars that will beep, and it will change frequency. and you can figure out what's in front of you. So they have devices like that, and there are people out there who are blind who are able to use their hearing to know where things are. So there are devices out there that you can hold, and based on the tone, it will tell you, you know, how far you're away from something. It will tell you how fast you're walking and what kind of an obstacle it is. K2RIW, WB2HWW.
Okay, for a sight-impaired person using this cane that emits tones, is there a tone coming out of the cane that strikes objects and you hear the echo from that object and then interpret that with your hearing? Or is there a whole lot more electronics in that cane which really transmits a tone, listens to the echo of the tone, and then converts it into a signal in some means? Give us a few more words as to how much electronics is in the tone and what is the sight-impaired person specifically listening for. He's listening for echoes. I presume the amplitude of the echo tells him something about how big is the object and how close it is. And is there a shift in the tone that tells him how fast he's approaching the object? As I said once before, how much electronics is in that cane? Roughly how many dollars is the cane? WB2HWW, K2RIW, and the second net.
Hi, Dick, I don't know. I have never used a cane, but I've actually seen them. But I've never really used one. But yes, they do change in frequency, and the person using the cane is trained to know that if the frequency goes up, he's going faster, and if it goes down, he's going slower, stuff like that. So the cane will keep changing in speed. What he might have is something in his ear, like a little earbud. What I do, and what a lot of blind people might do, is sometimes whistle or say hello, and people will laugh at you. I might be passing a building, and I'll say hello, and what you're doing is listening for the echo. You can tell off the echo, you know, what your environment is, and as you're walking with your feet, you can hear the reflections. And the more you get to know, the more experience you have, the longer you are blind, you get to figure out what's happening in your environment. So because you can't see, you're using your hearing, and sometimes you do what a bat does.
Okay, good information, Harry. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to go on to the next person. Steve, KD2HUC. What would you like to discuss tonight? K2RIW and TechNet.
Hey, good evening, Dick. My question is involving something that was discussed a couple of weeks ago regarding LED lights. And I was curious if anybody else happened to notice that they may be a lot more sensitive to fluctuations in voltage than, you know, the previous forms of lighting, so to speak. I have I have some CFLs, I have some incandescents, and I have some LEDs. And I noticed that the LEDs tend to flicker a lot when, you know, loads that intermittently, you know, increase current draw. Let me let it drop. For example, I have a hot water heater that uses a switch SCR to cycle the heating element and to modulate temperature, and you can actually see the LEDs flicker as the SCR is firing. I also have a large air compressor. It seems like they flicker when it comes on, and you can almost tell when the compression stroke is on the compressor by watching the lights, the LEDs flicker. Mind you, this is only LEDs. The CFLs don't respond like this. The incandescents obviously don't. And I've ruled out any issues like loose connections and stuff like that. It just seems to be the most minute fluctuation in voltage, and you can actually see an intensity change. And I was just curious if anybody else has noticed that. KD2HUC, back to net.
Steve, I've got a guess as to what could be going on here. In the case of a incandescent bulb, for instance, you raise and lower the voltage. By a relatively slow function, the filament of that bulb is going to burn a little bit brighter, a little bit dimmer, and there's going to be some change, but the filament also has a lot of thermal mass to it. So only a very slow modulation of the voltage you would see as a flicker out of an incandescent bulb. In the case of a fluorescent light, the 110 volts 60 cycle creates an ionization of the mercury vapor inside. That mercury vapor puts out the ultraviolet light. The ultraviolet light hits the phosphor. The phosphor gives you visible light. But the ballast inductor that you've got in your fluorescent lighting fixture is an extremely good constant current generator. So again, until you get the very large differences in temperature, some fluorescent lights, if you don't buy the special ones, they won't start on a 20 degree day. If it's if in your shed outside it's 20 degrees and you want to turn on the fluorescent 4 foot long light bulbs, they might not ignite. But except for temperature sensitivity, once they finally do ignite, they're not very voltage sensitive because that ballast inductor is very close to a constant current generator into that bulb. Let me drop. However, a light emitting diode is a little bit like a Zener diode. If you had the right series string of light emitting diodes so that the whole series string was supposed to be, let me pick a number, 120 volts, and your wall socket is putting out 120 volts, you're getting normal brilliance. If your wall socket went down to 105 volts, the possibility exists that all the light emitting diodes will go out. It's a Zener diode. It's got a very sharp curve of voltage versus current. As the power supply that's inside of a light emitting diode circuit has to be a fancy piece of electronics maintaining either a specific voltage or some particular constant current into those light emitting diodes in order to have them work correctly as a function of high and low line voltage, high and low temperatures, and so on. Let me drop. And there's the rub. In order to make a really good circuit that can accommodate significant swing in voltage and yet make sure the light emitting diodes are getting exactly the right voltage and exactly the right current, that's a pretty fancy regulator that's got some bucks involved, if you know what I mean. It's got real operational amplifiers and reference Zener diodes and whatever. It's the way to do it right. And I think because light emitting diodes started off at very high prices. I mean, the ones for your house started off not too many years ago at numbers like $25 and $30 per bulb. Now they're coming down to very low prices. They're getting very competitive. And it is my guess that they've really cut corners on the constant current power supply that's feeding the light emitting diodes. So I think you're seeing the failure of a greatly cheapened regulator circuit that's feeding those light emitting diodes. The light emitting diode itself responds very rapidly. If you made a dip in voltage that's only a few milliseconds, the bulb would very rapidly change its brilliance in that length of time. A fluorescent or a incandescent wouldn't do that. A compact fluorescent wouldn't do that. But a light emitting diode operates so rapidly, it operates so rapidly that as the headlights and taillights that we put on our automobiles are now becoming light-emitting diodes, they are going to be putting very high-frequency circuits in there that blink the light so fast that the human eye doesn't see it. But now the individual automobiles will be able to talk to each other. So if you have the slightest flicker in voltage or current going into that light-emitting diode, the light output will change significantly during that period of time, and they can move very rapidly. So it is my guess that you're seeing a greatly cheapened voltage regulator on the particular light-emitting diodes that you're using. That's my guess as to what could be going on, Steve. KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I imagine it would be it. The ones that I have are made by Cree, and they weren't, very inexpensive, I think. I think they're probably about $18 each, but And, you know, it's funny you say that, because the ones that, come housed in, you know, to look like an old incandescent bulb, I'm not noticing it that. I notice that these are actually designed to retrofit, you know, hi-hat cans. And like I said, they're made by Cree. They're about 75 watt output, you know, the light equivalency. And it's just, it's really noticeable. And, you know, I mean, I tested the voltage fluctuations. Let me let it drop.
Audio V2GXM on the comment.
GSM recognized, but Steve, finish your statement. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, the, I mean, the voltage fluctuation is you know, so fast that you can't regular DV. And I noticed it, you know, plus or minus 2 volts when looking at it on a scope. You know, that's how I found the first, the SCR firing on the water heater was a culprit. And, you know, like I said, nothing else in the house is really, you know, where you notice it. But, so. And K2RW, KD2HUC.
That's interesting that different brands at different price, at different costs, have different amount of flicker. That would be a partial confirmation of my hypothesis that the quality of the voltage regulator is what we're talking about here. Rich, WB2GXM, what's your experience with light emitting diodes, and what do you think is going on? You've got it, Rich.
WQRW and the group, WB2GXM. I do have Cree bulbs. I outfitted the entire first floor of my house with Cree bulbs about 2 years ago at a cost of $13 each. Most of them perform well, but I have one which turns off entirely for about 2 months, 3 months. Then it comes back on for about a month or 2 months. Goes off, comes on, goes off, comes on. It makes me crazy. WB2GXM.
It sounds like it might be an outdoor light that you're feeding voltage to it continuously. That's how you know it's going off and on. You're not trying to command it. And wherever it's located, is it seeing temperature extremes, Rich, is my first question. And if not, is it mounted in a fixture where it can get an adequate airflow? In the case of an incandescent bulb in one of these top hat type ceiling-mounted fixtures, an incandescent bulb can tolerate some extremely high temperature without any damage, whereas these light-emitting diodes and the regulator, voltage regulator circuit cannot tolerate super high temperatures. So if the bulb is running hot in that fixture, not getting enough airflow, you can drastically decrease its life expectancy, in my opinion. So it sounds to me like you've got it somewhere in your house as a nightlight. You want it to run 24 hours a day. And what kind of temperature and weather extremes is it seeing? Over to you, Rich, K2RIW.
Not outdoors, Dick. This is actually in the bathroom. But it is inside an enclosure, and it's probably a high humidity environment. So that could be a factor. It is, in fact, a Cree bulb to concur with what Steve is looking at. And, yeah, you'll probably have a point there. That's the only bulb of the entire Cree series here in the house that's given me a lot of problems. I do notice that some of these LED bulbs will burn out in sections. There'll be one or two sections along the bulb that'll burn out. The rest of it'll keep on going. WB2GXM.
Yeah, describe that to us, Rich. Blows out in sections. In other words, some of these bulbs look like an incandescent bulb. In other words, the front end surface is a hemisphere, a white hemisphere, and if sections of it burn out, do you see a streak of darkness across the bulb? What does it look like, Rich? Go ahead. Wait for the beep.
Absolutely. The bulb I use in the front hallway has one entire dark streak along its length, and the rest of it is working well. So I do see that the regulator circuits probably are in multiples inside the bulb, and one or two of them can fail. That's my guess. K2RW, WB2GXM.
Here I'm not sure, but I'm going to make a guess that each individual light-emitting diode runs on something like 3.3 volts. I just picked a number out of the air, but it's in that neighborhood. And so now you have all kinds of series, parallel combinations of individual light-emitting diodes in order to come up to some reasonable voltage. I mean, to start off with 120 volts RMS coming out of your wall, which hits 167 volts peak of the sine wave, and regulate it down to 3.4 volts would be very difficult and inexpensive. By putting a whole bunch of bulbs in series, you're now regulating down to 80 volts or some other easier to achieve voltage. But in order to do that, they're running series and parallel combinations inside of that bulb. It's a pretty complicated wiring scheme, is my guess. And so if one of those strings in that parallel combination develops an open circuit, then you get this this characteristic you're describing. And so it's probably seeing high humidity, maybe high temperature. You would think that there would be the equivalent of a hermetic seal on each of the diodes. You'd like to think there's a hermetic seal on each of the transistors and zener diodes and everything else that's in the voltage regulated circuit. Kind of circuit boards. I mean, although the humidity in a bathroom can be very high, that's nowhere near as severe an environment as a salt spray test that you would expose military electronics to in order to confirm its the reliability for a particular application. Your bathroom is nowhere near that severe. So therefore, I'm having trouble understanding what is the failure mechanism. Over to you for any further comments, Rich, K2LIW.
Oh, that's about it. That's the two problems I'm having. They're actually two different bulbs in two different sections of the house. The one in the bathroom just goes on and off completely for a long stretch of time. But just to add to this conversation, you can't say the LED bulbs are completely there yet. K2RW in the group, WP2GXM, clear.
Rich, have you ever considered replacing that bulb with another Cree to see if in that environment does the exact same model number do it again, or is there something funny about that particular serial number? Have you considered replacing that bulb even temporarily? Rich, go ahead.
A sensible move. I should do that. It's a little bit difficult to replace bulbs, but yes, I should do that.
And when you gather that additional information, please come back and tell us what you found. So the scientist in you has got the capability of giving us some more information so that we can find out what's really going on here. Okay, we've come to the end of our list of people who signed in, and it's been a while since we've heard from John, KC2WGB, and my guess is he's continuing to answer people's questions, which it's real dedication. I mean, all we have volunteered to do is to answer these questions on the air, and I think he's doing it in private life, even though he's not on the air. So have you got some nice, juicy questions? And are these college students sending you their homework assignments? I'm joking a little bit here, John. KC2WGB and the mailbag, K2RIW and the TechNet. Glad to hear from you.
John M2EO, Love it, Dick, and hello, John. I had some more comments about the LEDs, but John could go first. Go ahead, Dick.
WB2HWW with a question on the last subject of LEDs.
We're going to hold both Rich and Howie in a bay. We're going to go to John first. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Yeah, it's nice to partake in this. I have a lot of fun with it. Yes, I have a question from a young man who recently bought a Hickok tube tester. Beautiful one. He sent me a picture of it, and it's working beautifully. But he doesn't understand the gassy function to check for gas. He would like a description of what is it, why is it detrimental, how does the tube tester do that, what is it measuring, you know, see if you can give him a good walkthrough on that. And I thank the other ones for waiting. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if this is the best of all worlds, your vacuum has a extremely high vacuum inside. The voltage that you put on the control grid has a strong influence on controlling how many electrons leave the cathode and go to the plate. So the instantaneous plate current at a constant supplied plate voltage is highly dependent on the exact voltage on the control grid. The control grid itself is a floating piece of wire in a vacuum, and quite often the if the circuitry of your radio is using that tube as an audio amplifier, for instance, the actual audio signal gets coupled into the control grid by way of a coupling capacitor, so the high voltage on the previous stage doesn't get into that grid. The grid itself might be running at 0 volts, in which case you'd have something like a 200 kilo-ohm resistor from control grid to ground, and that controls the voltage on the control grid, but the 200 kilo-ohm resistor represents very little load, so therefore the previous audio amplifier stage is able to deliver almost all of its voltage to that control grid in that circuit. Now, if the tube is not well manufactured, if the materials that were put inside that vacuum tube have a characteristic called outgassing, let me drop it. If the manufacturer didn't do a good enough job cleaning up the raw materials he put inside of that vacuum tube, and inside that hard vacuum, the tube starts, the material starts outgassing, starts emitting air-like molecules into that vacuum. There's also a gettering surface in there. When you look at a vacuum tube, quite often you'll see a silvery surface where they have flashed a material in there which is intended to act like flypaper to air molecules. And so if that flashing is not doing a good job, and if the vacuum seal on the wires coming out of the bottom of the vacuum tube are not doing a good enough job and air is slowly leaking in, there's a bunch of methods by which foreign materials can start drifting around in that space inside the vacuum tube that should be a hard vacuum. Let me drop it. And if you do have air molecules in there, and now by way of the electrons being emitted from the cathode, striking those air molecules on their way to the plate, they are ionizing those air molecules. So all of a sudden, what should be a hard vacuum and extremely high resistance internally, you now have this plasma-like material in the volumetric inside that vacuum tube, acting like a bleeder resistor. And so now, depending on the geometry of the control grid, how close it is to the cathode and how close it is to the anode, and the anode might have 200 volts on it, and the cathode might have something close to 0 volts on it, and now this plasma in that vacuum is acting like a voltage divider network. That's one possible experience by which the control grid starts developing a voltage other than the intended 0 volts in my example. So by way of the gas inside the tube, you now have a bleeding function taking place that's putting some erroneous voltage on that control grid independent of your external circuitry. Let me drop it. So in one possible scenario, that plasma inside your tube is now pulling that control grid to more positive voltages, and now all of a sudden the tube is nowhere near as normally controlled. All of a sudden the tube, because of the higher control grid voltage in my example, the plate current would be a lot higher. Depending on how bad the gas is, some of those electrons leaving the cathode strike these air molecules, never get a chance to even get to the plate, and so the plate current goes down, the control grid voltage goes up, the tube starts acting nonlinear, you start hearing audio distortion, so there's a whole lot of undesirable characteristics. What a tube tester can do is to apply a voltage to the anode, ground the cathode, and with an extremely high impedance circuit, measure what voltage appears on the control grid. If the tube has absolutely no gas, the control grid will be running very close to 0 volts. If the control grid starts drifting to some other voltage, the highly sensitive vacuum tube voltmeter connected to that control grid as part of the tube testing circuit will swing a needle saying, this tube is gassy. It'll go out of the green region into the red region on that Dawson valve movement and tell you the tube is gassy. There's a bunch of guesses on my part, but I think this is close to how some of those tube testers work. Over to you, John. Drag your feet in case we have people a little bit more familiar with tube testers on frequency tonight who can correct some of my errors. KC2WGB, with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, John.
Very good. I'm sure he has a better understanding of what it's actually doing. So, basically, in most cases, we're looking for an excess of voltage on the grid itself, which is due to the gas function. Would that be a clear synopsis?
Yes. In all of the possible tests that your tube tester can do, applying plate voltage and cathode voltage and looking for an extraneous voltage on the control grid, that would be one indication of guessiness. Another indication would be to have circuitry that forces a very specific voltage on that control grid, forces a very specific voltage on the cathode and anode, and looks for a specific amount of current. If the current is low, it indicates one of two things. Either the filament is low, the cathode is low on emission, because it's very old and contaminated. And by the way, the gas in the tube can also contaminate the cathode and affect its longevity as far as an emitting surface when it's hot. So if you get the wrong amount of plate current with a very specific voltage put on the plate and control grid, that also is an indication of possible gas. So there's a number of tests they can do to indicate whether or not the tube is gassy. And those are my two best guesses as to what could be going on. Too low a plate current, the wrong voltage on the control grid, and maybe even a linearity test, if you know what I mean. By putting a sine wave voltage on the control grid and looking for the quality of the sine wave on the plate current. KC2WGB, K2RIW. And so we can go this one a little bit further if you want to, John, or do you have another question? You got it, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I guess the quality of the testing is the reason why some of these tube testers are so expensive. The ones that do exactly what you're saying, they have a projected, an expected result from a formula setup, and they apply that, and if it's out of that realm, it's bad. So, yeah, that explains some of the pricing for sure. Yes, I have one more. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on with that. Okay. I have a young man who's interested in a radar question, and it concerns glass. He wants to know if the radar, it probably depends on frequency, but he wants to know, glass is an element that radar can detect. If you were to put up a pane of glass, you would be able to measure the distance the glass is away. He wants to know, does it also pass through the glass, and what is the attenuating factors, if you know?
Yeah, this comes close to what happens when you're calculating, I can't think of the name of it now, Fresnel zones. When you're calculating Fresnel zones of a particular propagation path, I've got my transmitting antenna on this mountain, and 10 miles away on the top of another mountain, I've got the receiving antenna. And so I've got nothing in between the two as far as my binoculars are concerned. Nice clean air. Well, the transmitting antenna really isn't a perfect pencil beam. It's got a beam width of, let's say, 20 degrees. So some of the beam width of the transmitting antenna is striking the tops of the trees that are off the path, off the direct path. And trees on a nice dry day are made out of an insulating material, and you would think the trees create no problem. Turns out you get a significant reflection off of those dry tree leaves and even the dry tree branches, because once that radio wave is issued into air, it wants to see nothing but pure vacuum or pure clean air, 377 ohms per square. You put any other material in that air, I don't care if it's a dry piece of wood, a clean piece of glass, a thick pieces of paper, whatever. Whatever materials you put in that path, even if they are non-conducting materials, They have a certain dielectric constant. They have a different characteristic impedance compared to the air around it. Therefore, you're going to get a predictable amount of reflection from every material you put in front of that antenna.